we'll get into more details in a little while. And the title of my thesis is called Stories with Stackable Extensions. And the idea that the problem that I address is that storage is everywhere, and it's always expanding, right? Every day we create an increasingly amount of data, and this data has to be stored somewhere. Sometimes we store it in our laptops or portable systems. Sometimes we store it in a network server that we might have at our homes or offices. And other times it goes into some other storage appliance or somewhere in the cloud. And the issue is that as storage grows, there are some challenges that we need to address. In particular, there are performance challenges, right? We always want data to be accessed quickly. We don't want to be waiting for a minute to a file to open or have a long latencies to access files, even though we haven't accessed them for a long time. The second challenge that we face is reliability. We always want data to be accessible, and we don't want to lose any data even if some disaster happens, right? Even we don't want to lose our pictures that we took of our babies or our pictures that we took of a wedding or special events with friends and families, right? And more important, documents that may contain sensible information. There are also problems regarding power consumption, right? As we increase storage, the technology is not, as we create more data, the technology to store this data is not improving as fast enough. So every time we need more devices to store this data. And this will eventually create a problem in terms of that we will need significantly more energy just to keep these devices running. And then there are always, as always, security concerns, right? We don't want wrong people accessing our files or our programs or looking into our data. And as such, we need to make sure that our data is kept safe and accessed only by authorized users. And finally, there are challenges regarding the management of these systems, right? We want to make this system scalable, but also manageable, in a sense that administrators can easily plug in extra features of those systems as different scenarios come up. And this is a real challenge that many companies are facing right now. And I'll talk about all these challenges a little bit later on. So the good thing is that industry and academia people want to help. In particular, in our group, we have identified some areas that we saw that we can improve. For instance, one of them is static data placement. Currently, file systems lay out data statically on this, meaning that once you write a file, it's always going to stay there. But one of the things that we found out is that if we were to relax this constraint and let file systems evolve over time as the workload changes, we can significantly improve access time performance of the system. The other area that we found that we could substantially bring new things is to leverage new storage devices, right? Nowadays, flash devices are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And we can simply, we design some systems that take advantage of those devices that combine spinning disk and flash devices or solid-state devices into a storage system that performs better and more efficiently. And the third challenge that we saw in our group was that we could also, one way to improve storage is to reduce the data footprint, right? If we were to compress the data if we were to need less physical space by using techniques like compression or deduplication, we would require less resources from the storage system. However, implementing and achieving this improvement doesn't come easy. There are many challenges that we face. In particular, improving storage takes time. We have to understand how the storage stack works. We have to understand how each device works. And that is non-trivial. It requires some expertise that needs to be gathered during some amount of time. Second, it is difficult to develop reliable and consistent improvements, meaning that every time that we come up with a new idea, and we want to bring it and present it to someone to an administrator, he wants to be sure that improvement works all the time, that no data is lost, that your system will not crash, and in order to provide those guarantees, you have to be really sure of what you're implementing, And finally, given also by the fact that it's hard to prove that this is working in all cases, adoption will be very slow of these systems because administrators are very reluctant to add something to their systems that they're not sure it works great all the time. Right. Okay, so this leads to my thesis statement. So in this dissertation, we improve the state of the art in block storage, in block layer storage, by designing and implementing self-managed block layer extensions that utilize existing and emerging technologies in new ways. Then we create an infrastructure to simplify the development of these block layer extensions. And finally, we develop a theory that simplifies deployment and management of these extensions in production systems. Well, this is very abstract, and so let me present you the picture of what I do in with a simple diagram. So the first thing that I do in the thesis is develop some block layer extensions, right? So we see here, the idea is that these block layer extensions are the building blocks of a more complicated storage system. And then, so after we develop these extensions, the first thing that we found out is that there's actually a lot of commonality between them. So we came up with this set of infrastructure that's composed of some tools that help developers create block layer extension in a more easy way. One of the offsprings of this infrastructure was persistent memory. When we were developing these extensions, we found out that one of the things that typical extensions need is to keep data persistent. And that led us to the creation of what we call persistent memory. The other thing that we saw is that even though after we developed these extensions, they still need to be used somehow. And for that, we developed a theory that helps deploying block layer extensions into storage systems. So that means that once we have the extensions, that theory will help administrators utilize those extensions in a way that is appropriate to achieve his goals. And as a consequence of this, we also came up with a way to comparing block layer extensions that extend this theory that we created. Because I have a constrained amount of time here, I'm only going to go into the details of the infrastructure, the theory, and comparing the block layer extensions in this presentation, but the rest is in the dissertation. Okay, so I've been talking a lot about extensions, stackable extensions, but what exactly do I mean by that, or what do I want from those extensions? So the first thing I want those storage extensions to be is easy to develop. I want developers that once they come up with an idea, they have a mechanism to implement them with as little effort as possible. The other thing is that I want is that once those extensions are developed, I want them to deploy to provide guarantees to administrators and enable them to deploy those extensions easily, so that they are very easily pluggable and unpluggable from storage systems. And the other thing that I want those extensions to be is autonomic. I don't want them to be interactive. I want them to take decisions by themselves to implement some level of intelligence. Right. So with this in mind, we created three extensions. The first one is Board, which it was designed to improve performance by tracking access patterns, data access patterns, and we noted that there is a significant amount of those access patterns that repeat, or you have what we call partial determination between them, meaning that some part of them repeat. And what we did later is that part that repeat, we put it in a separate partition in a sequential fashion. The other thing that then we develop access that simply takes advantage of flash and a disk, and what it does is that it uses the flash device as a cache and turns off the disk to save power. And then after that, so the idea behind access is that it was intended for portable systems like a laptop or even a desktop system. And then we came up with EDT, which stands for Extent-Based Dynamic Tiering, which takes into account the leverages the characteristics of multiple device types, meaning SSDs, SAS disk, and SATA disk, and leverages those characteristics by putting data in the most adequate tier at given intervals. And by that, it improves performance and lowers power and cost. So what did we learn after, what did we learn after we implemented this? The first thing is that developing these extensions must be done in a challenging programming environment. Why do I mean with this? Typically, these extensions are developed inside the OS, inside the kernel. And the kernel, as we all know, is a very complicated, it's a long piece of code, and that is a very challenging programming environment because it has multiple levels of concurrency, and you have things like interrupt context going on and interruptions going on, and that the programmer has to be very aware of and has to have significant amount of knowledge just to develop inside it. The other challenge that we looked at, that we faced was how do we move data consistently between, just moving data consistently. There are many scenarios that come up with. I'll illustrate that point a little bit later on the presentation, but I just want to point out that there are many things that can come up when you're moving data, and you have to address all of them in an adequate fashion to be able to not lose or corrupt data. Then the other challenge that we saw was creating persistent data structures. This requires, so like I said before, many extensions create data that requires persistence, right? For instance, all of the extensions that I just mentioned before have some sort of indirection map, right? They indirect the data in somehow, and that map has to be maintained persistent in an efficient way. And that was the challenge that we faced with creating persisting those data structures. And finally, we also saw that handling corner cases and errors were the most lines of code. And so, meaning that the code that once we developed the extension, we got all those corner cases, the code looked very good and it was very readable, but after we plugged in all those possible scenarios that come up with, the code wasn't so elegant and easy to read, right? But we believe that all those corner cases can be, and all those scenarios can, or at least most of them, can be handled by some external infrastructure, and that will free the developer from having to implement that over and over again. And the other part of it is that from the administrator point of view, we also saw that administrators usually have a hard time determining what an extension, the influence of an extension on a data volume. Right? By this I mean is that once I deploy this extension, how is it going to affect the data that is in the volume and the I/O traffic to one or multiple volumes that I have on disk? The second is that even if it's already hard to reason about one extension, imagine what happens when you have multiple parts of the storage system working together for a for a high level goal, right? That becomes even more complicated. And most of the times administrators don't have the tools to reason about that. And finally, making sound deployment decisions is not trivial because, like I said, administrators always want to ensure that data is kept reliable and consistent. And the fact that he has limited amount of data of what the extension does and how it behaves limits what he can infer from those extensions. So with this in mind, we created the ABLE project, which stands for Active Block Layer Extensions. And the idea that we have behind ABLE is to change the status quo of current storage systems by doing three things. The first thing is that we improve developer experience by providing an infrastructure that allows developers that already has a lot of the common functionality that they typically need in order to develop block layer extensions. The second thing that we do is that we simplify storage system administration by providing a theory of how do we incorporate those new extensions into the storage system and that allows the administrator to always achieve the goal that he wants to do. And what we provide in a more concrete term is that it's an infrastructure, like I said, for developers, the theory for administrators to reason about how to deploy those extensions, tools that allow him to make that reasoning possible, and then some case studies that illustrate how do we use our system, right? How do we develop extensions and how do administrators use our system? Okay, so let me paint the whole picture of what ABLE is. So from a top level, we have applications, and those applications interact with the virtual file system. Usually the applications are in user space, and everything from here on downwards is in kernel space. The VFS in turn interacts with the file system, and after the file system, everything is in terms of blocks and interacts with and the file system will interact with the IO scheduler. I think it drops on. Should I wait or?
So let's find out who got dropped.
Yes. Let me see who got dropped. Things being done.
No, Jorge, I'm here.
Okay.
Kaushik.
Kaushik?
Yeah, it shows a question mark. He did join back, but again, I think the call dropped.
Okay, let me add him again. Hello? Kaushik, are you there?
You may be on mute. Seems like he's connected.
Yeah, it seems like he's connected. Should I continue then? Or make sure?
Yeah, let's make sure he is.
Kaushik, are you there? Yeah, it seems like he's not here. I don't know if it's ringing or...
Yeah, that might be a good idea. Hang up and dial him again.
Hello. Hello. Okay. We lost you for a bit.
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me, Kaushik?
Yeah. I got cut off from some reason. Yes.
Okay.
I'm here.
Okay. Okay. Good to know you're back. okay. So I'm gonna. I was explaining the ABLE architecture, and I'm gonna continue. Okay. So, like I said, we have the applications communicating with the virtual file system, and that communicates with the file systems and then the IS scheduler. And what we do is that we we plug in Able between the file system and the IS scheduler, and that's what we call the block layer, because everything from then onwards is dealt with in terms of blocks, right? And the first component that the Able interacts with the system is by the I/O router. And the I/O router is a simple component that what it does is that it forwards I/O to the extension stack. You can have as many extensions as you want in the extension stacks, and those extensions usually utilize Able primitives to do their task. This Able primitives have many things that enable have an API that I will go over it in a bit, and that API provides functionality for instance, move data around. And then at some point, control comes back from the Able primitives and go back into the I/O router, and I/O proceeds to the I/O scheduler. There's an additional component that is the reasoning engine, and that's the one that administrators interact with, and that's the one that knows all the theory about extensions stacking. Okay, so how would developers go on and use Able?
Can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
So what is complexity over this whole Able infrastructure in terms of the harmonizing code, and how do you compare this to something like Fuse, that everything in this space,
mm-hmm.
and Able minimum framework in this space?
Yeah, so, Fuse is very simple. Right. First of all, Fuse doesn't provide the API that we provide. We have, for instance, an I/O library that allows you to manipulate IOs, whereas Fuse simply forwards IOs back and forth between user and kernel space. That's the first thing. And that's the major difference between them. And that, having said that, Able does provide some of the things that the Fuse provides, for instance. It allows you to register and unregister extensions. That means that it allows you to have things that interact with the stack, right, and add them and remove them at any time. And yes, I mean, they're quite disjointed. Well, and the other thing is essentially that the Fuse is a file system interface. And translates from a file system interface to a block interface, whereas Able is always dealing with the block layer interface. Right? It's always below the file system.
Yeah, I guess the question is which I know this one star system has block and block layer. Your question is which design is the better design? Is the default complexity in kernel space or the default most complexity in kernel space? It's really the same idea of what resources you can use in kernel space.
I guess it's hard to argue. I mean, always if you're going to develop in user space, you will have some benefits that it's easier to debug and develop in a sense. But then you will have extra overhead every time, right? You will have four extra interrupts for every I/O that you issue. And that will ultimately account for a significant amount of overhead. And with Able, what we try to do is that take away some of those complexities of developing in the kernel by gathering most of the tasks that we feel extension developers do, and that way they can just focus on developing their algorithms and not worry about stuff like how do I correctly allocate memory and deallocate memory, how do I take care of all the cases of when I'm moving data around and stuff like that. Right, so we wanted to take away most of the hard parts the hard part of developing in this very complicated environment, and have it more be something like you can just focus on your algorithm.
How many actual code you have?
Yeah, so Able is around, if I believe correctly, was around 5,000 lines of code.
Okay.
right, with all the components. Yes, there is a component when we implemented Able, the persistent data structure component was a very primitive one. We later developed another more complicated and complete one in user space, and that's the software persistent memory project. Yes.
I have a question. I wonder if you guys have some sort of a metric to kind of tell if you guys are effectively, taking away work from the program.
Yeah. I'll go into that in a couple of slides.
All right.
Okay. So.
Yeah, I had a quick question.
Sure.
So I'm trying to imagine. So some file systems, right? They actually also do. Let's take the extension example of data placement or data movement dynamically. And let's say the file systems also, some file systems operate on raw disks and they manage the space and they manage the data placement themselves and do not rely on an underlying layer to do it. So how do you envision Able getting deployed in scenarios like that? This is the classic case of, two layers in a stack trying to do the same thing, and would that cause more chaos, or would it actually converge to a system that's performing well?
Okay, so the good thing, I mean, yes, I am aware of that, and usually what happens is that there is no Able layer, right, in systems. But what we wanted to do with Able is that sometimes if you want to add some feature to your file system, you will add it and it will be implemented in a particular file system. However, if you add it to the block layer, once you implement that, it will be available to all file systems that you have in your system, right? So in a sense, it simplifies development, right? And what we essentially do is what you just said. We handle raw devices and make an interact with raw devices, and by that we completely change what the file system behavior, right? So in a way, it could be either complementary to what the file system is doing or completely disjoint, right? Because for instance, you could if you implement a cache enable, then that cache is going to operate completely independent of what the file system might be doing on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just thinking that. When you have scale-out systems or clustering kind of approaches, yeah, in a single node system, that kind of division of responsibility is still, I can parse through it, but in a cluster system, it seems like either Able needs to know of the clustering or there has to be some interaction with the file system.
Okay, so Bindu, you are getting ahead to my last slide of future work.
Okay, sounds good. I'll let you proceed.
Okay.
Thanks.
No, but it was a very good question, Bindu. Thanks. Okay, so let me. So I'm gonna explain how the copy block operation works. Okay, so if we have a simple data migration scenario, where we're migrating data from this one to this two, and then let's say we're migrating blocks zero, block one, and block two, and then we're currently in this status where we have already migrated block zero, we're currently migrating block one, and plan to migrate block two in the future. So what happens if an I.O. comes and that I.O. compasses all blocks zero, one, and two? How do we handle that I.O.? What happens if it's a read or if it's a write? Okay, so if it's a read, the way we're going to handle that I.O. is that for block zero, since it has already been migrated to the destination device, we're going to issue that I/O to this two. For block one, since we're currently moving that device from one block to the other, that moving operation is composed of two operations. First, we have to read the data from this one. Once that read completes, we issue a write to this two. Right, so this I/O could have come in any time between that. If it came before I issued the I/O to, or just after I issued the I/O to this one, then we simply have to wait for that I/O to complete and get the data from that I/O. If the I/O had already been issued to this two, then fine, we already have the data and we don't have to issue another I/O. And for B2, what we do is that we issue an additional I/O to this one because that's where the data resides. Okay, so this is how we handle a write. So let's see how we handle a read. Okay, so in the read, in the write case, what we do is that we issue all I/Os to these two. Why do we do that? Why is it so different than the read case? It's quite simple. So if for the data that we already had migrated, we will simply write it to these two. There's no point of writing it to this one. Now for the other two, what's going to happen is that for the data that is being migrated, if we had issued the read I/O and we're pending for that read I/O to complete, we have a new content that's going into that block. Meaning that if we write what we just read, we're just going to write an outdated version. So that's why we need to write the new data to this two. And for B2 that hasn't been written, what we do is that we issue the I/O to the destination device, and then mark the migration of block B2 as it's already migrated, right? And thus we don't have to complete additional work. Okay, so
just to clarify,
sure.
Because like what you want to illustrate here is that Able does the copy block for you,
exactly,
and consistently handles the foreground
mm-hmm.
I/O request,
exactly,
at
yes.
the same time.
That's true. Yeah. So exactly. That's the point of this slide. It's essentially explaining how all the possible, well, some of the corner cases that come up when you're migrating data, right? Just moving data around. There are other scenarios that involve fault tolerance and all that, but yeah. I mean, this is just one of those corner cases. Okay, so we went ahead and implemented a couple of extensions using Able. The first two I already explained, Borg and Exis. Then we implemented what we call a simple RAID 1, which has all the features of a normal RAID 1 minus the rebuilding of a failed disk. We also implemented a read after write extensions. It essentially verifies that the contents that you write of an I/O is what you originally wrote by issuing a read and then comparing it with the original write. And finally, an encryptor extension that encrypts the data that's going to the disk. Okay, so we measured the lines of code that it took to implement both what we call the vanilla version, which is the original version, and the Able version. And here I present the reduction in number of lines of code. Right. So we see that it varies from 12 to 76% in the case where we have the most reduction. And we believe these are significant savings. But we also went and measured the number of what we call kernel lines of code reduction. And by kernel lines of code reduction, what I mean is that those lines of code that deal with kernel data structure and handle issues like concurrency occurring in the kernel, right? And there we see that the reductions are much greater, right? The one that reduces the least is for the encryptor extension is 20%, and for the RAID 1 is almost 90%. So we see, in conclusion, we see significant reductions in development complexity measured by lines of code, even higher code reductions in terms of lines of code that manipulate kernel data structure. And the good thing is that we added very little overhead, runtime overhead, I mean. In the worst case, we saw a 4.5% runtime overhead. It's not shown here, but it's all you can see the experiments in the dissertation. Okay, so that's what those were the benefits for developers. So what does Able provide to administrators? So what we build for administrators is an automated reasoning, an automated reasoning theory that simply that helps administrators add extensions to their storage system based on some high performance goals. Some high level goals, for instance, performance, or it could be power saving, or anything that they specify. And the way it works is that it examines interactions between extensions before they deploy them. Okay, so let me illustrate this because all this is very accurate. Let's suppose we have a case scenario. So let me read out the case scenario for you. So recent security concerns have driven ABC Technologies to encrypt the contents of its drive. And they have an additional constraint is that the data center they're currently running on is very tight on its power budget, and managers are worried about the increased power usage due to extra CPUs activity by encrypting data, right? So what should a storage administrator do? It's very easy. It has to deploy extensions that allow the system to encrypt the data and also allow them to lower the power consumption. And how does he do that? How can he combine those extensions? Well, he will simply use Able's reasoning engine to determine an adequate ordering of those extensions in the stack. Okay, so let's assume that the administrator has two extensions to play with. The first one is the encryptor extension that encrypts the content to the disk, and it works as this. It looks at the I/O flow and then issues IOs, encrypted IOs to the disk. We see by the gray arrows denoting that the I/O content has changed and is encrypted. And then he also decides to deploy an Nexus extension that uses power, that saves power by caching data on a low power device and spinning down the disk. Nexus works by looking at the I/O flow to the disk, copying data from the disk to the flash, and then distributing the IOs between disk and flash. Okay, but how does he incorporate disk extensions into the stack in order to achieve his goal? Okay, so what Able will do is that it say, okay, there are two scenarios. We can stack the encryptor extension on top of Access, and by that we will have the following behavior. IOs will come to the encryptor extensions. They will go to Access encrypted, so all the content from there downward will be encrypted, and then Access will issue IOs to the disk, copy data from the disk to the flash, and issue IOs to the flash. Notice that in this scenario, both the disk and the flash are both encrypted. And then the other stacking option that he has is to put Access on top of the encryptor extension. In this case, if we look at the I/O flow, it's very different, right? So initially, all IOs will come to Access. Access will split the IOs between those going to the disk and those going to the flash. And only those going to the disk will actually get encrypted, and the flash contents will not be encrypted, right? And at this point, what Able does this all automatically for you, and it will tell you. If you choose the first stacking ordering, meaning that if you place the encryption in top of Access, you'll get better security, right? Because both of your drives will be encrypted. But if you choose a reverse order and place Access on top of the encryptor, you will get better power efficiency because you're not going to encrypt all the data, only a part of it, right? What all the misses that you have from the cache. So at this point, the administrator will say, okay, what's more important for me, security or power efficiency, and then deploy those extensions according to his needs. Okay, so having said that, yes?
Quick question. Just wondering, this previous slide on the right-hand side, is that possible that you can also encrypt the data between EX and the flash memory?
Yes. Yes, you could potentially have let's say two instances of the encryption,
yeah.
and running them you could have let's say one instance of encryptor per device that you have.
Yeah.
Right?
That is also possible.
Yeah, that is also possible. But that will yes achieve the same goal as this one, right? As the first ordering, as putting the encryptor on top of Access, that essentially all the I/O flow will get encrypted.
So how do you, given the building blocks like CR and EX, and this component, how does your algorithm actually enumerate the order possible combinations?
Yeah, well, it does exactly that. It goes through all the possible combinations, and it does this analysis. It does it in an abstract term by looking at what goes into the extension. I mean, what we call the input domain of the extension, and what is the output domain of the extension. By input meaning, okay, I will that this extension, what's it tracking? For instance, we see that the encryptor extension is only looking at IOs that go to disk, and all the IOs that it will issue will always go to disk. Whereas the access extension is looking at IOs, at IOs that go to disk, but it's issuing IOs to both disk and flash. Right, and based on that, it reasons. We develop some stacking rules and that enable to deduct this sort of knowledge.
Thanks.
Okay, no problem. Okay, so like I said, the reasoning engine is based on the extension stacking rules. And these rules allow you to determine the influence of an extension on a data volume. These extensions, like I just explained, are based of the input and output domains of individual extensions. And the idea is that ABLE will reason about this and come up with what we call a concept that we call dominance, meaning that which extension is going to be more influent on the IO path given a particular stacking order. Okay, so this is all great, but then and we saw that ABLE help us to determine stacking orders between different sets of extensions. However, we also found there are some shortcomings to the ABLE theory. In particular, let's look at this other case scenario. Let's suppose XYZ Incorporated is growing at a very fast pace, and as such, its storage servers are very congested, and the storage administrators are noticing performance is going down. So what does he do? In this case, let's say he has two extensions, and both are designed to improve performance. One of them is a caching extension, and one of them is an Ethereum extension, right? So the caching extension is very simple in its working. It's simply all the data that's not on memory is going to look for it on the SSD. If it's on the SSD, it's going to return it. If it's not, then it's going to issue the IOs to the hard disk. And it could have many levels downwards, right? The Ethereum extension, what it's going to do is that it's going to distribute the data among all the devices that it has, and it essentially considers all the devices in the same level, and it's just distributing data, putting it in the adequate tier, right? Okay, so which one should he deploy? Caching or tiering? Right, so this is a question that ABLE doesn't answer. ABLE only allows you, the current theory that we have with ABLE only allows us to reason about how to stack different extensions that accomplish different goals. But it doesn't help us to choose which extension to deploy when we have multiple possibilities that work in a different fashion. Right, and so, this is what I just said, that the reasoning engine is unable to provide a concrete answer to the administrator in this case. And we ask ourselves, how can we extend the extension stacking rules to allow this sort of, to allow some reasoning or inference of knowledge in this scenario? And what we did is that we chose to study extensions, those two particular extensions, and see how they behave, in order to address two questions. First of all, which extension is more suited for the workload? And then, after we have addressed the first question, we want to see if there's anything that we learned during that process that allows us to extend ABLE to handle more cases or to infer knowledge about for individual extension behavior and allow administrators to provide some answer in cases like this.
Okay, quick question.
Sure. Go ahead, Bindu.
So you mentioned that, yeah, when there are two extensions that are both improving performance, that's what we'll see the reasoning of, how do you reason across those two extensions? So the question I had was the extension that you had, the security versus the previous example, security versus, the power saving. So although they are aimed at different objectives, they will have their own performance impact. Would the reasoning engine be able to give some, because encrypting the data will have some impact on performance.
Yes.
Would it be able to give any intuition on the performance impact in that sense, or that is also something that the user needs to deploy and figure out?
So, the performance impact the user will have to figure out by itself. It's unable to provide a concrete answer to that. However, the way it works is that usually the administrator will say, the developer will say, what the extension does. By that, he says, I developed this extension to improve power, right? Not improve power, to improve security or some metric, some very high-level metric. And one of the things that we thought at some point of extending ABLE to do is just say, okay, provide some level in which it improves a metric, and that way we can compare multiple extensions. But we didn't get very far on that, right? So the short answer is no, it can't. The administrator will have to deploy it and figure that out for themselves.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so essentially we want to extend we're going to see if we can extend the ABLE theory, and we proceed by comparing these two extensions. And let me just point out some of the workload characteristics that we're going to push into the extension. So we look at two traces, one we call MSR, that is from some guys at Microsoft, and one FIU, that is from our home server here, where our homes and user files and mail is collected. We see that these traces are most read intensive in both cases, and overall across the 7 days they look somewhat like this. We see, in particular, in the Microsoft trace, we see some periodicity. Every 24 hours we have this peak. But in the FIU trace, it's harder to see any concrete pattern, right? Okay, so So these are the workloads that we subject our study to. And what we do is that in our empirical methodology, what we test is two things. First of all, we look at sensitivity of the extension to different configuration parameters. So the first thing is, We test individual extensions. We look at caching by itself and test different parameters to see how it behaves. And then we look at tiering by itself and look at a whole set of parameters and see how they behave. And then we take the best performing configuration of those systems and compare them, right? For the same workload. Okay. And in particular, in the sensitivity, the parameters that we look at are chunk size and algorithm for both caching and tiering. And in the caching case, we look at the write policy and the cache size. And in the tiering, we additionally look at the epoch length. By epoch length, meaning the period that elapses between times when I reconfigure the contents of each drive. Okay, so Let's look at the sensitivity of cache. So to measure the sensitivity of the chunk size, we didn't want to run whole sets of experiments to get the miss ratio curve. So what we did is estimate the hit ratio. And that estimation allows us to calculate the miss ratio curve. and it works in the following way. Given an IO active sequence, let's say the one that we have here, ABVACB, what we do is that we calculate the relapse reuse distance. By relapse reuse distance, means that, for instance, from the appearance of the first A to the second A, there are 1, 2, and 3 different IOs that occur, right? And then from the occurrence for the second occurrence of B and the third occurrence of B, there are also 3. But for the first and second occurrence of B, there's only 1 IO, right? Okay, so what I do then is just plot this in terms of occurrences on the x-axis, on the y-axis, and reuse distance on the x-axis, and I get some distribution of the reuse distance. However, if I look at it at this in a different way and see, okay, a reuse distance of x indicates that if I had a cache of size x, I would get a hit, right? And that allows me to change the x-axis from reuse distance to cache size, and then for the hit rate, and then what I do is just say, okay, I have x amount of IOs. In this case, I have 6 IOs, and for a reuse distance of 1, I have 1. I had that it occur once, right? So that's 1/6, and that's the hit ratio that I'm going to plot here, and proceed to plot this in a simulated fashion, right? And at the end, so that means that for a reuse distance of 3, I have 2 occurrences plus 1 that I have of size 1 and 0 that I have of size 2, meaning that I have 3/6 IOs that will get a hit, and that will translate it to a hit ratio of 50%. Okay.
Just to clarify here, the alternative to this is to run an actual replacement algorithm for every cache size.
Yes.
And what you're doing is approximating the same information using this relaxed reuse distance metric.
Exactly. Yes.
And can you give a sense for why you're doing that? I mean, why this approximation?
Yeah. So, like I said, if I were to calculate the actual reuse distance instead of this approximation, I would have to rerun a caching simulation algorithm for each individual cache size, right? What this allows me is just to do on one pass, calculate all the reuse distances, and then come up with a mishit ratio curve that tells me what is the hit ratio, what is an approximate hit ratio for every cache size, right? So that way I only need to run one experiment instead of the different number that I want to run for a different
time.
Relax, okay, because the typical definition of reuse distance is says how many unique blocks were accessed between this time and the next time that you access it. Meaning that from the first occurrence, if I were to use the typical definition, from the first occurrence of A to the second occurrence of A, there's only B that catches. So that would be a reuse distance of 1 from A to B, 0 from B to B, and 0 from, and another one from A, B to A, right? Because only there's, if I had a cache of size 2, then I would get a hit, right? And this is why if you look at the plot where it plots the hit ratio and cache size, the dotted line represents the actual hit ratio and says that for a cache size of size 2, I had detected that hit, whereas here I would only detect it for size 3. Right, so there is some error that I introduced, but usually the error is quite small. Okay, so yeah, like I said, what I did then is just calculate the mishit ratio curve for different chunk sizes, and here I have again on the y-axis the cache hit ratio, and on the x-axis the cache size in logarithmic terms, and what we see here is that this is a really nice observation and indicates that if I have a cache size of 1 megabyte, we see this gray line over here, and if we have a cache size of less than that,
unit size.
Sorry, yeah, not cache size, chunk size. If we have a chunk size of 4 kilobytes, we see this the lowest curve here, right? What this means is that actually using 1 megabyte chunk sizes will provide a higher hit ratio than using 4 kilobyte chunk sizes, right? So this implies that, like I said, bigger chunk size, we found that observation to be true only up to 1 megabyte. After that, it decreases. The hit ratio decreases substantially. But bigger chunk size up to 1 megabyte provides a higher hit ratio. But this is very contrary to what everybody believes, right? Why is this happening? And the reason is that in storage workloads, there's a lot of spatial locality. So in this next plot, we see here on the x-axis the cumulative percentage of IOs, and on the y-axis we see the inter-IO distance, meaning how the distance between the spatial distance between one IO and the next one. So if I have a distance of 0, means that the IO is exactly the next page on disk. If I have the next block on disk. If I have a distance of 4K, means that it's the next 4K in the disk, right? And what we see here is that for 4 kilobytes, there's only about a 10% probability that the next IO will be for the next 4 kilobytes. However, if we look at the 1 megabyte, if we look at a 1 megabyte distance, we see that we will be able to capture more than 60% of the IOs, right? And what this implies is essentially that if we use 1 megabyte chunk size, we're essentially prefetching data. There's any way going to be requested in the near future, right? Because of this spatial locality. Okay, so the other parameters that we tested, like I said, were algorithms. We tested two algorithms, LRU, which is least recently used, the most commonly known caching algorithm, and MQ, which stands for multi-queue, and it's an algorithm that is designed specifically for storage-level caching. Right, we see here that MQ performs better than LRU for both of the workloads. This is across the 7 days, right? And then we also looked at cache size. We found that bigger caches lead to bigger hit ratio, like we just saw. And the write policy, we tested two write back, in which both reads and write IOs go to the cache device, in this case the SSD, and write through, in which we update first the disk, and then when the write comes, we update first in the copy on disk, and then the copy on the SSD. Okay, so for the tiering case, in this case, we did run some actual experiments, and what we did here is that we varied the size of the chunks. We experimented with more, but I'm only gonna choose the 1 megabyte, 4 megabyte, and 16 megabytes here. And what we have here is that on the x-axis we have the time that it takes to service the IO, and the y-axis indicates that the cumulative fashion, right? So here we see that for 1 megabyte chunk sizes, about 80% of the IOs completing 1 millisecond or less, right? And whereas for 4 megabyte and 16 megabytes, we see that only about 60% of the IOs will complete in 1 megabyte or less. And in general, we see that the 1 megabyte curve is always above the other two, meaning that 1 megabyte gives us the best performance for tiering, right? So in conclusion, for tiering smaller chunks leads to better performance, However, the drawback is that smaller chunks also require more metadata, right? And this is something that has to be taken into account by administrators, because in the case of tiering, the amount of metadata will be a factor of the size of the storage, right? Okay. So with the results that we got for the other method, for the other variables that we looked at for the algorithm, we tested a greedy that is just IOPS based, and it places data based on IOPS, so meaning that the data that gets most IOPS is placed on the SSD, and the data that gets least IOPS is placed on the disk. And another one that is utilization based theory, that is essentially the algorithms that we implemented for EDT, for the EDT extension. And both of these, we tested what we call throttling detection. And throttling detection is simply an algorithm that allows us to look at, to detect if one drive is oversubscribed, meaning that its performance is deteriorated, and make minimal changes in the data that is placed on that drive and migrate that data to another drive to alleviate the congestion on that drive. Okay, and and we also tested, in terms of epoch length, we tested different epoch length, the performance under different epoch length. The results for this are on the dissertation. And like I said, in this next part where I compare the extensions, I use the best performing configurations for both of the systems, right? So once I did all that sensitivity analysis, I proceed to compare those systems under their best case scenarios, right? And I compare them under five different dimensions. The first one is workload adaptability. I see how quick do they adapt to different workloads? How best do they leverage the different devices that they have? How do they leverage how effective do they use the SSD? How much metadata they have, and what are the reliability concerns that one can have with the different extensions? Okay, since we're almost out of time, I'm only going to focus on the workload adaptability feature comparison. Sorry. And here we look at, again, we have the service time curve, and we look at two different experiments. One is long-term trends, and the other one is change in working set. For long-term trends, what we did is that since we have seven-day trains, we took the first 5 days, trained with those 5 days, and then ran the sixth day, and see how the performance looked like. And we ran for 1 megabyte tiering, 16 megabyte tiering, and caching. Both write through and write back with 1 megabyte in both cases. And for changing working set, what we did is that we trained for a small amount of time. We only trained for a 2 hour period of the, no, sorry, 6 hour period of the trade, and then started running the work after that. And this is what the performance that we got here. Right. In this case, we tested with 1 megabyte hearing 16 and 256 cases. That's the lowest performing one, and just 1 megabyte write back caching in this case. So what we see here is that for long term trends, caching performs better than tiering. This was also somewhat unexpected for us, and
caching. Write-back caching.
Write-back caching performs better than tiering. And for change in working set, we see that the performance of 1 megabyte chunks and on 1 megabyte tiering is somewhat comparable.
Right. Write-through caching actually does worse.
In this case, it does worse,
and
yes.
Long-term trends.
Mm-hmm. For the period that I ran. There could be other periods where it does better.
This is a one-day period, right?
This is a 12-hour period.
And it's a random sample.
It's a random, no, it's exactly the next 12-hour period after 5 days.
Right, but what I mean is that you weren't carefully choosing which period.
No, I wasn't doing any of that. Okay, so that's for workload adaptability. So in I'm going to summarize the finding for the other dimensions. So like I said, for workload adaptability, tiering with small chunks can be in some cases as quick as caching. However, tiering will in all cases utilize more overhead than caching, in some cases up to 10x. In terms of leveraging device heterogeneity, caching can oversubscribe the SSD device. However, the caching, since it always tries to put everything that's accessed on the SSD, we believe that as SSDs improve, the performance of caching will also improve with it. So this is something that we might not have to worry about that much in the future. And finally, we saw that in terms of reliability, caching moves a lot more data around, meaning that it's always pushing and evicting something, chunks to the cache, and thus there's a lot more updates to the persistent map, and that requires developers to be a lot more careful when programming all that. Okay, so if we remember, we did all of this to see what we could find out that we could help Abel with. And what we saw is that it's very hard to infer behavioral knowledge about autonomic extension. And although we found some interesting things by doing this study, we noticed that the results can vary a lot by the workload, right? When we look at the long-term trends and the short-term trends and all that, and the hardware can also vary. If the performance of the SSD were not as good, then those experiments could give out some results that are completely different. So these leads us to argue that determining which extension performed best among two that were the same code is probably a non-deterministic problem, right? And it's so we're not sure if we're going to be able to add anything to the ABLE theory that will help administrators solve that question. Okay, so with this I conclude and I present the summary of my thesis contributions. So we presented three storage extensions that showcase performance, power, and cost savings. We also presented an infrastructure that simplifies the extension development process and a mechanism to easily manage persistent data structures. Kachika, I'll finish with this slide and I'll get back to your question. And a theory to reason about storage extension stacking, and an empirical methodology to compare and contrast extensions. Okay, so Kachika had a question. Let me see. Where's the question here? Okay. What will the impact of solid state drive be on the proposed approach? I don't understand the question. What about cloud systems where the workload varies upon?
Sorry, let me clarify the first question. The solid state drive is solid state storage systems, really. So, in many large storage systems, now they're going for the solid-state storage systems. So will your approach be similarly applicable on those scenarios? That's what I'm asking.
The what will be singly applicable, you said?
Will your approach be similarly applicable on those kind of storage systems?
Yes. I mean, in terms of the way that you compare the extensions, yes, it will be similarly applicable. Yes.
Okay. There will not be any change or anything like that? Will you see the similar kind of benefits?
The things that, like I said in my previous slide, we might see different characteristics of either caching and tiering performance for a different hardware, right? If the SSDs are substantially better, in this case we use Intel SSDs. If we were to use some, let's say, faster SSD like Fusion I/O devices, then we could have probably gotten very different results than what we saw here, right? In terms of performance. And that's what led us to say that there's hard to infer some any deterministic knowledge about the extensions, by itself, and it's going to be hard for us to add anything significant to the ABLE theory that allows administrators to infer that sort of knowledge.
Okay.
So. In terms of future directions, so all of the work that I presented here is based on centralized storage, right? So everything, you have all your hard disk and SSDs in a storage array, and then you could have, and you have multiple hosts communicating with that. So in the future, I plan to look at problems that go beyond that and say, what happens if we have a mix architecture where we have hard disk on the storage array and SSDs on host. And what happens if we have a completely distributed architecture where we have both disk and SSDs in host, right? How will I engineer extensions to work in this sort of scenarios, right? How would these extensions change in the way they're built? And what about how do I make those persistent, distributed persistent data structure? I think those are some interesting problems that I would like to work on in the future. And with this I finish, and I want to acknowledge before I end my committee members, Raju Rangaswamy, Himabin Dupusha, Ming Zhao, Jinping Wei, and Kaushik Dutta, and also my collaborators and co-authors from both FIU and IBM Research. Some of them are here, some of them are not here. So here is a list of my publications. Also put the number of citation on each one of them, except for the last one that was just published a month ago and currently has no other citations. And there are also, apart from this, there are other publications that I'm working on. There's an ABLE paper that we submitted and is currently under review. And then there is another paper that is based on the comparison between caching and tiering that is also under preparation, and we plan to submit it soon. And here are some of the references that I use. And with this, I'd like to conclude and thank you all for attending. And we'll be happy to take any questions.
Now it's an open forum. Anyone can ask questions, including the committee.
It's more a comment. I don't know if you mentioned that in the dissertation, but it seems like ABLE is a nice framework to also, for instance, gather statistics of the storage itself.
Yes. There is a component of ABLE that is extension profiler.
Okay.
That it takes care of exactly that. It gathers statistics about the performance of both extensions and physical devices.
Somebody that has tried to do this very same thing that you're trying to do?
Well, there is, in terms of ABLE, there is some related work. There are some people that also have looked at this. There are two particular projects that are very related. There is one from the FreeBSD people, and I forgot the name of it right now. Geom project, and they essentially also build an infrastructure, but it's significantly simpler than ours. they don't provide all the guarantees, but nor all the API that we provide. It's just to enable you to plug in and just do things like issue IOs and stuff like that. They don't handle all the corner cases, for instance, like in the copy blocks operation, right? And then there is another project
called Violin.
Violin, yeah. Yeah, the other project is called Violin, and that one addresses, they also wanted what they want to do is just, they provide some API similar to ours for extension development, but they don't go into the reasoning aspects, and they have a much simpler persistent memory abstraction than the one that we have. Well, the Geom project is open source and it's already on the FreeBSD kernel. And the Violin project, I'm not sure about that one. I think it's not open source, but it was published about 6 years ago, something.
And you guys plan to put your project in open source and people can download?
Yeah. I mean. Well, there are some restrictions that the university places upon that. Raju's more familiar with those. But yeah, depending on that, we usually proceed and publish or not the code.
Any other questions in the audience? Okay, so if not, we'll have a closed session with Jorge and the committee members now. If you're not a committee member, wait and for Jorge outside.
I have two more questions for you. I just supposed to get you on the Skype. So whenever you get the chance, just answer those things.
Okay, so let me look at the questions again. Okay, so the second one is, what about cloud systems where the workload varies based on applications running on the current systems? Okay, so and what's the background on that? So how would I infer knowledge on the extension? Or
I think the question is, interpret it the way you want. I mean, interpret it the way you think is most relevant to your...
Okay. Okay, so in those scenarios, I mean, there are going to be a lot of changes to... Since the workload is constantly changing, the systems need to be probably more reactive, right? And more adaptive to be able to handle those workload changes, but also more resilient to failures of the system, right? Since clouds can sometimes get disconnected and are subject to failure of nodes, they have to be designed with those characteristics very deep inside them. And it's something that we don't address right now, it's because all this work, like I said, is based on centralized storage. I do plan in the future to start looking at what sort of issues we can address in a distributed architecture like a cloud. And the second question is the impact level of application caching. Okay, so there has been some studies and about what happens when you have multiple levels of caching. And what some people say is that it's true that you could have redundancy if you have multiple levels of caching. However, what I believe personally is that they're completely different problems, right? The application might know a lot more about them, about how the application is performing, but the system knows about the whole how the whole system is performing, right? So maybe the application wants to handle the cache in its own way, and knows what's going to be accessed in the future and what's not. better than what than the generic policy that the system implements, but the system is also gonna can potentially provide more guarantees in terms of things like quality of service for different applications and fairness of caching and that sort of things that it's very hard to provide in application caching. So while they sometimes can be conflicting, I believe that in some cases they are also complementary and in a sense disjoint in the type of features that they provide.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Kasi.
Other questions? Bindu, do you have any further questions?
Yeah, a couple of them. So Jorge, I was wondering, so yeah, it was a really good talk and I think really enjoyed learning more about ABLE. So
thank you.
A couple of questions that pop in my head are, you talked about how you could use the ABLE infrastructure to develop some extensions. Have you socialized it further than that to see, when we write code, it is also easy for us to imagine how to use it. But the whole idea of ABLE would be for, developers
yes.
simplify developing these extensions.
Mm-hmm.
Have you socialized this idea further to get an intuition of, how one, somebody not familiar with, but deeply familiar with the ABLE infrastructure inside could use it,
Yes,
open-ended question.
Yes.
Yes.
So the short answer is no. So, but the long answer is that so when we started developing ABLE, we had a lot of projects in mind, and the fact is that the development of ABLE took and the idea was that those projects were to be developed using ABLE.
Jorge, you're breaking up. Sorry, I'm not able to follow you.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. So when we started developing ABLE, we had a lot of projects in mind that would potentially utilize ABLE. However, the fact is that the development of ABLE itself took more time than we initially estimated, and those projects had to be developed somewhat independent of ABLE. Right, so we were not able to conduct that study, although we initially were hoping to do it. So, but I believe that the knowledge that we gather with ABLE, if our lab in the future decides to go and develop more block layer extensions, all that knowledge can be simply reused in the future and we hope to see developer benefits in those cases.
That's good. And yeah, I think that would be a very important, hopefully when the work gets published and so forth, you continue gathering feedback, because I think an exercise like this is very important and the success of it is also as much dependent on how people adapt to an infrastructure like this. The other couple of questions, again, one thing that I'd like you to speak a little bit is, could you summarize the limitations or the scope of ABLE? So what, specifically, let me say why I'm asking you the question. So we talked about how peering versus caching kind of question, right? That's something hard for ABLE to answer. But I'm also thinking, is it overlap in, so they both are addressing performance, and that's why it is hard to reason about it. But is it more that, or is it the intersection of techniques? So what I mean is, maybe we do data movement for saving power, maybe we do data movement for saving or improving performance. So at the underlying, so the metrics are different, but the technique is somewhat similar or overlapping. Is that, so that's kind of, can you summarize what the limitations are of ABLE, what's the scope of ABLE, and where it will not be able to help with the deployment of extensions?
Yeah. So one of the things that we argue is that when that ABLE reasons about what we call dominance, meaning which extension will be most active when deployed, right? That's what what Able infers. But there's an additional concept that with what we call effectiveness that indicates how which extensions will actually play a role when deployed, and there could be multiple levels of effectiveness, and that will depend on how active is the extension, right? And that is something that we think it's very, very hard to reason about because, again, it goes into the problem of knowing internally how the extension behaves and finding a way to formalize that, right? And we believe it's very, very hard. It's very hard to infer behavior let's say formal mathematical behavior of a dynamic algorithm that adapts to things like workload changes or different or failure models and things like that. So although we are seeing that we illustrated some of the use cases where Able is useful, but we do feel that there are some limitations, and like I said, in particular, those are the most complicated cases when the extension has a lot of intelligence, right? The more intelligent the extension is, the harder it is for us to infer knowledge about how it works.
So Jorge, to slightly expand on that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jorge.
Okay.
In your work, you actually developed a theory of dominance.
Yes.
Right? And that theory of dominance tells you that given a stack of extensions, which extension would be dominant in its behavior on which specific storage volume or device.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what it tells you.
Yes, exactly.
There is an argument in your work where you say that a dominant extension is also effective, meaning that,
mm-hmm.
and the definition of effective is an extension that accomplishes its intended goal,
mm-hmm.
right? So for instance, if you have an extension that targets power saving, if it's effective, that means that it actually saved power.
Yes.
Right? In the way it wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
So if a theory, if a extension is dominant, which is what your theory is able to reason about,
mm-hmm.
it's also effective,
yes.
right? And which means that it will accomplish its goal.
Mm-hmm.
So that part, your theory can address. In these terms,
yeah.
in these specific terminology, what does your theory not address?
Yeah, well, essentially, it's about all the other ones that are not dominant, right? So I don't know if you guys heard, but Raju was asking the question, is that in the dissertation, I mentioned that dominant extensions are also effective, right? So in that sense, what is the Able theory not able to address in terms of effectiveness? And my answer is that although we know that the dominant extension is effective, We don't know anything about the extensions that are not dominant, right? If they're effective or not, and that's the main limitation it has, right? We argue in the dissertation there are some cases where we can actually say something about effectiveness, but we cannot definitely state what effectiveness in all possible cases. Right.
So can you give us a sense of your dominance-based theory? I mean, what does it involve? And you have the stacking rules grid, right?
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to project it here. And could you guys go to the slide that is after the thank you slide? There is one... Okay, So I have, so essentially the ABLE theory looks, the stacking theory looks looks exactly like this. And the idea is that in this grid, we have two different axes, one that looks at, one that looks at the inputs and the other one that looks at the outputs. And the reasoning is essentially goes in the following fashion. From this looks very complicated, but the idea is that if you have one extension, and that extension receives some input, and it's modifying that input in some way, that the extension that goes beneath it will not look at that input, then we say that extension is going to dominate, right?
Use names like A and
okay.
B. Because
yeah, so if we have an extension A, let's look at, let's look at the second row and the first column, right, for instance. So in the second row and first column, we say if we have an extension A, that its input is it's bigger than what the input of extension B is, right? Let's say we have an extension A, it's looking at all, the input is all IOs that go to the disk, and extension B, the input is also all IOs that go to the disk. And the output of A, when you intersect it with the input of B, is disjoint, meaning that essentially what extension A did is that it redirected everything that was going to the disk, to other device, then we say that A is dominant, for instance, right? That's how the rules work, right? And then we have, this is probably the simplest case. Then there are other more complicated cases when we have overlapping the inputs and outputs and things like that. And like I said, in those cases, in all cases, we're able to provide definite answers to dominance, right? And
since dominant extensions are effective, given that a certain extension is dominant, you can say that it actually accomplishes its goal.
Exactly. So yeah. So in a sense, yeah. Since we're able to argue about dominance, we can say that. We can say that extension is also effective, but in this case, for instance, in the case that I just mentioned, that is the second row and the first column, we see that in that case, since in this particular case, we're actually able to reason about effectiveness because we see that since the input of since A is redirecting everything that originally could also go to extension B, and extension B is not going to see it, we see that extension B is essentially going to be ineffective. It's not going to do anything on the stack. But there are some other cases. If we look at in particular the third row, or where we see that there are cases where for some parts of the input, B is dominant, and for other parts of the input, A is dominant, right? So probably for those cases, we could extend the theory and reason a little bit more about effectiveness, right? But the things get really complicated, as I said, as extensions are smarter, because then the determining those, determining, let's say, deterministically knowing the behavior of the extension by indicated by the functions here is going to be very, very hard, right? That's essentially the piece that gets complicated.
So can I summarize and say that in this theory, you can reason about extensions that are dominant versus extensions that are not. Right?
Yes.
And if you know which extensions are dominant, you know that they are also effective.
Mm-hmm. True.
And if you know that an extension is not dominant, this reason cannot tell you in all cases whether the extension is effective or not effective. In
yes.
some cases, you know that the extension is not going to be affected.
Exactly.
Right? And in other cases, you do not know whether the extension is going to be effective or not.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
That's sort of, does that fully summarize the scope of your theory, or?
Yes, that summarizes, that summarizes it in a good way, saying that, yes, exactly. Yeah, we're able to always know about dominance, we're able to know about effectiveness in some cases, and in some other cases, we're not able to conclude anything definitive about effectiveness.
Towards the end of your talk, right, when you were talking about testing versus skill, it sounds like it's almost, you said it's non-deterministic. Sounds like there's no way to try and find an answer. That's the impression about that. Just imagine, you say you have all the time and you can't find an answer. Can you provide a path to solve that problem?
If I have what?
You can. I mean, you bet there's something you cannot, but there's a way to do it. The question is, what we call experiment. If I am a system, what should I do?
Yeah.
And
so
you are the smartest guy in the world. Can you provide something that's going to help you solve the problem?
So, I mean, like I said, the performance, the issue with these extensions that are autonomic and have dynamic behavior is that the performance will vary upon state that they observe in the system, right? So if they observe some particular system behavior, they will adapt to that behavior by doing something. And the issue is that then what's going to happen is that there are infinite states that your system can be in, right? And since your system can be in infinite states, you will have to definitely know how will your extension move or what changes will it do in each of those states, right? And since you're not able to enumerate all those states, then it gets very complicated, right? It gets complicated to infer that knowledge, right? So that's why we think it's probably a non-deterministic problem to start with, right? To give conclusive proof of formal proof of what's going to happen.
And what should we do?
What should we do? Well, so what we should do is proceed like we proceeded here, and it's just essentially benchmark the applications, benchmark also the hardware, and with that we could potentially see, okay, and then we could test the extension that we want to employ and see which one will perform better for our particular configuration. Right, and then there's also the other thing is that how do we configure those extensions, right? There are many different workloads that could come up in this case we were able to see, for instance, that the chunk size, we were able to give definitely a definite answer to that question, but there are other things that we could not give definite answers to. For instance, the write through or write back questions, which one will be better, right? That one will definitely depend a lot on the workload. So, I mean, there, yes, like I said.
But even the chunk size question would depend on the workload.
The chunk size question will depend on the workload. We took some assumptions based on the observed workload characteristics. If the workload changes drastically, let's say you have a completely random workload where you have no spatial locality, then probably the chunk size assumptions that we made are not valid. That's true, right? In those cases, you will have to mostly resort to benchmarking and testing the system by under different characteristics that it's going to be subjected to. To be able to infer what to deploy.
So, I mean, to follow up on Ming's question, what does how does an administrator deal with this problem, right? So can he, let's say, benchmark the extension somehow, the sensitivity of the extension to these various properties, and then as the workload comes in, create a signature of the workload, and then map it to these various configurations that you've already benchmark your extension with, and then based on that, you choose the extension.
Well, yeah, that's some way to proceed. We could say we could have a set of known behavior, let's say, of how the extension behaves under a particular load and what's the correct configuration for that particular load. But then we will also that will also lead to a problem of what happens when we have when a workload comes that we haven't seen before, right? I mean, we could anticipate for some cases, but like I said, there is an infinite amount of possible scenarios that you can come up with, and in order to know the correct answer for a particular scenario, you will have to test the system under that, right? So you could approximate it. That's another direction that you say you could. Like you said, if you have a fingerprint, you could have an approximate fingerprint and see what happens. But then you will not provide a definite answer. It's just an approximate answer, right? It's just a heuristic at the end.
So there is some hope.
Yeah, there is some hope.
The thing is that whenever you see a problem that is so difficult, you should not shy away from it. Instead, take that as golden opportunity looking to good research.
Yeah, that's a good way to see it.
Yeah.
That's
true. It's just intuitively, you know, if the system is so dynamic, then maybe the solution should also be dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine you can say dynamically switch between testing and theory.
Yeah.
And the dynamically change the parameters based on what you observe, right? So even though maybe the system has limited the number of states, but
yeah.
At any moment it's only going to use a few states.
Mm-hmm.
So you just focus on those few states.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true. You could argue that the other point being is that if the system is dynamic, then dynamically adapting will increase the complexity of the system. Therefore, you will have an even more complicated system than the one you started with. And I mean, I believe there is still some hope to gathering knowledge about it. I believe probably that the most significant branch that we could look at now is developing some heuristics. But there could definitely be other approaches that are worthwhile looking into.
Okay. Any other questions from committee members?
So Jorge, building on what you just said, I wonder if you could comment on if there's related work on modeling some of these things, because I think empirical way is one approach we could do to reason about things that we need to find out about extensions and stacking them. Is there any prior work, or have you thought about in the scope of the thesis to think about modeling simplistic models for some of these extensions and see if that helps the problem?
So I haven't found any. So,
Did you consider that approach?
Yeah, well, actually, what we do with ABLE is a very simplistic model. It's essentially we do exactly that. We model extension behavior in a formal way. There is some work by some people that use a utility base I think it's John Strunk from Greg Gagner's group, and they measure utility of extensions, right? In terms of service level guarantees. And they model utility in a simplistic way, but I mean utility only focuses on part of the problem, not on it, and it only gives you it only allows you to reason about one extension. I'm not sure how they would reason about multiple extensions, right? So that answers a related word question. And the other thing that you asked about...
So within a single extension, they are computing utility to do what? To understand the sensitivity of configuration parameters, or...?
I believe it was to... to understand the configuration of some parameters.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you imagine building on something like that for understanding patchability of extensions?
That could be some way. I looked at that work some time ago, and I remember that the problem I had with their model is that essentially what they did is that they re-ran things many, many times, right? So the model they came up with was very experimental. Was also empirical based, and the knowledge that they gathered was based on the results that they got from running things many, many times over, similarly what we got this year. This is probably one way to do it. The extension I was thinking of to this model of running things over and over again is looking at if we could infer some behavioral space, right? So how would combinations of different parameters affect the performance, so that we could see that that when we have x and y workload characteristics, this set of parameters is better than this other set, and so on. But the problem I have with doing that is that at some point, you're going to be faced with a different scenario, let's say a different hardware that hasn't come up, and you're going to have to infer some additional knowledge for that. And that's the challenge with taking that approach. But I believe that it's a good place to start. How do we model those particular extension behavior in a way that it englobes more of what ABLE currently addresses?
Thank you.
In other words, what you're saying is that although the behavior is non-deterministic, it can still be modeled at some level.
Approximately modeled.
Yeah, models are always approximate, right?
Yeah.
It can be modeled at some level, and it then if we are able to construct such a model, then we could possibly extend the ABLE theory with such models.
Yes.
So that's not the conclusion you draw in the presentation.
Well, I mean, yeah, the conclusion I draw in the presentation is different. It's basically what I say is that since it's a non-deterministic problem, it's going to be hard to reason about it, about this problem,
okay.
Right? That could be one way to reason about it.
Okay, so that may be one pointer for future work.
Yes, that's true.
Sorry, Raju, I can barely hear you.
Yeah, I'm sitting a little far away from the microphone. Let me come closer. So I was going to suggest that be one additional point of future work for Jorge's thesis, which brings me to the broader question for the committee members with respect to the thesis itself. If you have any particular requests or feedback for improvement of the thesis, then it would be good to have those either now or within the next few days, because Jorge would be improving the dissertation in the near future.
I think in 3 or 4 weeks.
Do you have a new version?
Oh, new version, no.
Since the one you sent
me,
you haven't changed
it. I think I do this. I understood this. Yes, yes. Yeah, but I do plan to update with some of the questions and things that we have come up with in this presentation. Particularly, the modeling that has been suggested is something that should be mentioned in the dissertation.
The other thing which came up while you were explaining this is that it seems like in some cases you can reason about ineffectiveness.
In some cases, yeah, you can reason about ineffectiveness.
And it would be nice to talk
point
about
out
that
those cases,
in
yeah.
the thesis.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
have a similar grid
mm-hmm.
of ineffectiveness.
Okay. That's
so
true.
You have a grid of dominance, you could have a complementary grid of ineffectiveness.
Okay.
That extends the theory in some way already.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I don't currently I don't answer that. I just state that you cannot argue it about it definitely in all cases. But it also helps to point out in which cases you can't.
Yes.
And in which cases you could probably do something about it.
I think that would be a fair addition, and that was my question around limitations. Sometimes it helps to understand limitations so that you can bound the scope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we could now limit ourselves to which cases do we need to model in a more complicated way, right? And yeah, that's true.
I was suggesting to talk about your vision and your vision.
My vision, okay, so.
Yeah,
how about
3 weeks?
Talk about
the thing about it. Okay.
So,
does the future work discuss any of the future directions you?
Yeah, so that's one thing that's lacking on the current version. There is no future work section. I do plan to add it and send a copy to you guys to look at that future work.
Okay. Okay. Any other suggestions? And if you have some pointers for Jorge, feel free to, of course, communicate over email with him. We'll now go into the final session. So Jorge, if you can leave the room.
Okay. You should turn that off.
Yes.
Okay.